From my beehive to yours, it's The Other Animals for October 16th, 2020. It just happens to be our 75th show. I'm Laurent Levy. Thanks for checking us out today. Hey, we got a great show lined up for today with, of all things, a real live bona fide Philadelphia connection. Now, you may not have known that back in the day when people were just beginning to become aware that humans weren't the only creatures on Earth who were fond of creature comforts, that in fact Philadelphia took a leading role in making that particular social epiphany mean something for some of those creatures. And I'm talking about dogs. This at almost the same time when in the rest of the country there was nothing less than a war on dogs going on, when some saw them as, quote, the most useless and dangerous of brutes, end quote. We're talking about a time before any kind of effective flea control was available and before any practical means of population control was possible. Dogs were mostly feral, scavengers, and worse, harbingers of hydrophobia. That's what rabies was known back then. So what happened in Philadelphia to begin to turn the tide? Well, my featured guest today, Ernest Freeburg, will enlighten us on that and other mind-blowing aspects of that consciousness-stirring period known as the Gilded Age. And we'll talk with him about his just-published book, A Traitor to His Species, Henry Berg and the Birth of the Animal Rights Movement. I will tell you, it is definitely a phenomenal read. And you'll definitely want to stick around to hear Dr. Tom Picard's segment today, dealing with the fine art of administering medicine to your pets, and maybe even what to do about it when you screw up, which, admit it, you have done. But before any of that, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, and welcoming back to our roving reporter, Dina Blumenthal, to help us out with the news. Hey, Dina, how's it going?
Hey, Laurent, I'm good. How are you?
All right. So what's good today?
All right. The first one, the headline caught my eye. Your dog may love you, but doesn't love the sight of your face, study finds.
Sounds ominous already.
To dogs, the sight of another dog is much more exciting than the sight of a human. You may think your dog's excited at the sight of your face, but research published Monday suggests that, unfortunately, she probably isn't. The study was published in the Journal of Neuroscience. It shows that dogs aren't wired to focus on human faces. Instead, they get more excited about the glimpse of another dog. So how they did this, they took dogs and humans. I believe it was the dogs were paired with their humans. And they put them in MRI machines and they took scans of both of them. Ooh. Both of their brains. And so they learned that while humans have this specialized brain region that lights up when a face comes into view, dogs don't. Okay. Both dogs and humans, however, do have a region that sparks when a member of the same species comes into view.
How do they get the dog in the MRI machine?
So they trained them. So they actually took a few months to train the dogs to sit still and not move. And they said the dogs, if they wanted to, were totally free to move. So I was happy to read that part. There was no coercion here. So the part that I thought was the best was that they showed both the humans and the dogs the front of a human face and the back of a human face. And they actually found out that for humans, obviously the front of the head that made their brains light up much more. But for dogs, the same.
Nothing. Okay, it's the same. Well, okay. So how do we interpret that?
It's not all bad news. They still learn things from your face. They still read your expressions. They also, though, look equally at the rest of your body language. So I don't think it's as kind of, horrifying as the title may have said. The dog doesn't love the sight of your face.
It's so much more. It's your body language. It's your scent. The dog knows it's you, even if it's not necessarily, I would think, a visual cue, right?
But it sounds like you could walk into your house backwards and you'd be fine.
Yeah, right. Why not? Just let that further study is warranted.
Further
right?
studies. Let's do that one. Yeah, let's do that one.
Yeah, for a few dollars, right? All right. What else you got?
All right. Next. So a rat called, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Magawa, was awarded a prestigious gold medal for Cambodia landmine detection. Recently, this rat became the first rodent to receive a gold medal for his work in sniffing out unexploded landmines and saving countless lives in Cambodia. He was presented with a small blue collar and mini gold medal by the British veterinary charity, the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals. So he is an African giant pouched rat. He was trained to detect landmines by a Belgium-based charity. Right. So sounds like, maybe this isn't so great. But because of rats' ability to sense smell, they have a great sense of smell, they have a great memory, and they're really light-footed. They can be trained in about 9 months, and they don't set off the landmines if they step on them.
Oh,
so that's the thing.
I was about to ask, you know, how many of the ones that got trained successfully did not get trained so successfully and are
exactly
in the minefield in the sky, you know?
But it says no rat has been harmed during the operation. So first, I was scared the whole time I was reading it until I read that part. I just thought that was so cool. I love that.
It's an interesting one of these. Like, is it, you know, because you and I were really interested in the human animal aspect of this, and it's like, well, is this an ethical application of something that we can do with an animal? You know, to actually, even though we're not putting them in harm's way, there's a warfare aspect. You know, is sort of implied with that. And you know, is my rat better than your rat? You know,
I mean, and we are using them.
We're using them,
but I'm glad that this rat is receiving recognition, right? Whether he cares about that or not, I don't know. I'm hoping he got treats as well.
I was gonna say the little medal is nice, but give me some peanut butter, right?
Exactly.
All right, one more. Got another one.
All right, one more. Ready for this one?
Okay, I'm braced. Here we go.
Female moles grow testicles to fight their brutal underground existence.
Oh, no. Okay.
So this is not a new discovery. Female moles, we know, they have an interesting anatomy. They have developed testicles on their ovaries, resulting in a unique bit of anatomy called the ovotestis, which, why do they have this, right? That was my question. It helps them be more aggressive underground in order to survive this, like, this harsh existence that they have underground in these tunnels. So just like a typical mammalian ovary, these ovotestes nurture and release eggs. So they still do that part. But they also have this lump of testicular tissue stuck to one side. I like how it sits stuck to one side. I thought that was interesting.
Okay.
It can't make sperm.
Oh.
It can't. It just releases the hormones.
The testosterone, making
the
it more
testosterone,
aggressive.
Yeah, and the androgens, as they call it.
And the androgens, okay.
So what was unique about this study, because they already knew that, but they found out how it happens. Without a Y chromosome, it makes it a lot harder for the chain of events when, something is developing to produce this. But in females, they found out, so it's been a mystery for a long time, but an in-depth analysis has just revealed how this came about in the first place. So they essentially found genetic code that activates the protesticular growth factor, FGF9. And they also found two extra copies of a gene that controls androgen synthesis. That's hard to say.
Yeah.
So they have, their genes have just kind of been slightly rearranged such that the code in their genes that was already there has been changed a little bit, and it now creates this interesting androgenous.
So, the benefit to the mole is increased aggression, which I'm in this time period, I'm stuck on the pronoun. Do we refer to this mole a he, she, it, they?
I think because all female moles have it. I think it would be okay to say she.
Okay. Well, let's go with that.
Right.
I mean, I would think, I don't know if she would be offended, but so the benefit, now that there's no counterpart, there would be no evolutionary counterpart for males getting progesterone or anything like that. What would be the benefit, which is interesting.
I guess not. If it's, I guess, it, you know, I kind of thought of it as this this increase in this like war mentality. Yeah. I mean, you could say maybe like pain tolerance or something would be a positive.
There's so much late night talk show fodder there, you know, as being your own best friend or, you know,
right.
But it's really compelling and it says something, you know, that there is a benefit to what's normally viewed as a negative aspect of hyper masculinity, you know, that aggression, but
right.
Given the right circumstances, it comes in handy.
Well, and it's also showing that nature isn't so black and white, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, you know, it doesn't need to be this binary thing, like a little bit of this, like whatever works. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's a really good point. And that really fits in with the theme of the show too, is that, we're not so black and white. We're not so black and white when it comes to what we do, how we confront and, you know, deal with animals and nature adapts. That's
right. Exactly.
All right. Hey, thanks, Dina. And thanks so much. And we'll see you again in a couple of weeks.
All right. Thanks, Laurent.
All right.
All right. When we come back, it'll be my conversation with Ernest Freeburg about Henry Berg. We'll be right back.
If we continue to consume our natural resources at the rate we do now, by 2050, it could take 3 Earths to meet our needs. The Earth can't speak up when it needs help, but we can. Be the voice for those who have no voice. Visit worldwildlife.org.
To fight for the right, without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause.
And there certainly are shades of Don Quixote when we're talking about Henry Berg, who tilted with the newspapers, the rich and powerful, and the prevailing attitudes towards what they called back then dumb brutes. Here now is my conversation with Ernest Freeburg about that Don Quixote character, Henry Berg.
If you're a student of human-animal studies or anthropology, you know the name Henry Berg because pretty much every course or book gives him a sentence or two. In some cases, even a few pages. And that's usually about it, a historical footnote about founding the ASPCA in New York. But after reading today's guest's latest book, I can honestly say that Henry Berg, and in particular, Ernest Freeburg's masterful handling of his life and legacy should be absolute required material for anyone wanting to understand just what the animal rights movement is about and the issues it continues to grapple with to this day, the commoditization of animals, the role of religion, the ethics of human versus animal interest. It's all there. Ernest Freeburg is a distinguished professor of humanities and head of the history department at the University of Tennessee. He's authored 3 award-winning books, including Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene V. Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent, The Age of Edison, and for our purposes today, A Traitor to His Species, Henry Berg, and The Birth of the Animal Rights Movement. Ernest, it's a real pleasure to have you on with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure too. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, before we get into the story of Henry Berg, why don't you set the stage for us a little bit by describing we know it as the Gilded Age, or we refer to it as the Gilded Age, but I think it's really important that, and for just getting a sense of when all this took place, when was the Gilded Age? What was going on at that time in the U.S. and the world, and what were people's attitudes towards animals at that time?
Well, the Gilded Age, there was a phrase coined by Mark Twain to describe a kind of a something that was seemed rich and opulent on the outside, but was cheap and flimsy on the inside. And this was really a way of satirizing a period that we think of as being corrupt. There was real bare knuckle, big boss politics going on. And this is also a period with enormous social problems, partly because the country was rapidly going through an industrial revolution. Cities that we know of today were really beginning to take their modern shape. And the Industrial Revolution was profoundly changing the workforce, you know, and begins the process of America becoming an urban nation. And of course, animals were right in the middle of this. Animals had been central to building the Gilded Age city and also, experienced many of the same traumas that the human inhabitants of the city also did.
And we're coming right out of the Civil War, right? It's fresh
right.
on people's minds, and are we still sort of licking our wounds?
yeah, certainly. I mean, this was it's surprising how little of that concerned Henry Berg, the character I was interested in, but certainly the whole idea of caring for animals and being concerned about animal suffering has a direct link to the anti-slavery movement.
Yeah.
Used a lot of the same ideas about the rights of any creature to not suffer unnecessarily, and they used a lot of the same techniques. A lot of the people, not Berg so much, but many of the people who joined with Berg in founding the animal welfare movement were directly coming out of the anti-slavery movement.
So they were making a connection. There was even then, it's been on we've talked about it recently on this show, just and how. It's a hot topic, you know, to make that comparison, but yet coming right off the end of the war, there it was, right? People
right,
making
sure.
that connection. Yeah,
I mean, Berg, his, you know, what he called animals, particularly horses, is our silent slaves. Mm-hmm. So it was right there.
Right there. All right. So one other just scene setting here, just for the Gilded Age, the mass media. At the time, it's essentially newspapers, right? Is there anything
sure.
else going on to that's you know, sort of helping shape public opinion and what people saw as normative and acceptable? I'm guessing probably churches, right? Religion, but
sure.
What is helping frame people's idea of what's acceptable and what isn't?
Well, I think you're right. Newspapers are really central to this and journals. This is the golden age of magazine journalism, especially later in the period when we start to think about the muckrakers and journals that were advocating for reforms. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And think of how often for Henry Berg, we'll talk about it. I'm sure the theater was very important to him as well.
Okay. Right? And so all this, you know, it's funny, we try to think about what, it's hard for us who are so influenced by essentially, you know, it's social media, internet, TV, you know, and even TV has faded, I guess. But those were really the powerful opinion shapers of the day. And I think, you know, just as we have this conversation, you know, it's important to keep that in mind. And I think what's important also is that, and tell me if I'm wrong here, that this would have applied fairly equally to an urban setting and a rural setting. And there's people even out in the away from the cities would read the newspapers too and could potentially be as influenced.
Sure. But much like today, the newspapers that people read out in the country were very much shaped by what was happening in the cities. Yeah. You know, so what was happening to Henry Berg in New York City or Carolyn Earl White in Philadelphia, these things were, you know, first showing up in Philadelphia newspapers, and then a week or two later, they might show up in Omaha or Wichita. So people were, you know, this is really the period at which the American cities became the cultural arbiters for the rest of the country.
Okay. All right. So that's important. That's an important distinction because they were kind of the setting leading the way. All right. So now we have our scene set. And I think it's kind of important. So what we know about Mr. Berg is that his background kind of comes from the theater. He has a little bit of that as a background. So tell us who Henry Berg is, how he came to how he came into this reality of his, and how he got things off the ground.
Well, you know, one of his friends years later described him as the riddle of the 19th century. And that was because he really seemed to care little to none about animals until the age of 53, mm-hmm. when he had a sudden intense conversion to realize that this was his life calling. He had grown up the heir to an industrial fortune. His father was a great shipbuilder in New York City. Berg wanted nothing to do with building ships, and so he took his inheritance and went off to the capitals of Europe and spent decades, married a socialite wife, and they went to the capitals of Europe and attended the theater and mingled with the wealthy. Really a sort of an extended vacation where Berg dreamed of becoming a great playwright, but apparently was really a terrible playwright, but you know, had the money to keep trying. And so he did this for many years. And because he had a such a strong connection to Europe. When the Civil War broke out, Lincoln asked him to serve in the embassy in Russia. So he was in St. Petersburg. Teamsters there were apparently even more abusive of their horses than they were in his native New York City. And so one day he finally, you know, just had enough. He snapped and demanded that a teamster who was beating his horse stop doing this.
In New York. So this event,
this was in Russia, in St. Petersburg.
Okay.
Right. And sure enough, I think because, you know, Berg thought, well, it was because he was wearing his gold lace ambassador's uniform, this teamster dropped the whip and immediately, you know, behaved. And Berg always described this as, you know, the moment that transformed his life. He said, okay, you know, finally found something worth doing. I'm going to devote the rest of my life to this. And he did. He lived another 20 years and became the leading figure in the animal welfare movement in the United States.
That's amazing. You know, we have had now at least three or four people like this that have had this epiphany moment. And it's always something like where they witness some abuse, and it's always involves a stick. It's like, I'm going to go back. It's of some sort of abuse where there's a beating and where something just snaps and they cannot abide it. They cannot accept this, and they just act. And this moment, it seems to be a watershed moment for people that become, I don't say activists, but leaders, you know?
Yeah.
What a common theme. All right. So this is interesting. He has this moment, late in life, relatively, you know, especially by his time in his 50s. And so he comes back to the U.S., back to New York. Now he's not, you know, he has some credo, I guess, you know, being a former ambassador and having wealth behind him. And he's able to constantly, or at least to get it off the ground, he's able to talk to the New York State Legislature. He's able to get things happening, and to pick us up from that point, he's able to.
He arrives back. He stops in, you know, it's important that he stops in England on the way back, because, you know, Berg did not found the societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals. He was adopting ideas that were developed in the 1820s in Britain with the Royal Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So he picks up some of his, you know, the rhetoric and the ideas about this and brings them back to the United States and adapts them in really important ways and, you know, moves in a much more radical direction. But he's, you know, he's certainly not inventing this idea. This has been around for a while. In fact, it's, you know, in Britain, it's the anti-slavery leaders who are also interested in animal rights, William Wilberforce and people like that. So Berg brings this back, and he does have influential friends, and so he has no problem getting the mayor and the police chief and some leading philanthropists to join him. He gathers them on a night in the winter to come out in a storm, and he issues what he considers to be essentially a manifesto, a declaration of independence or declaration of rights for animals. You know that this has to stop. And he takes that influence to Albany, to the legislature, and passes the first really powerful anti-cruelty law in the United States. And along with that founds the ASPCA, which is, you know, in spite of the name, it's not an American nationwide organization, but really is just the New York branch of this movement, the first state to do so.
Okay. So the legislature gives him, first of all, recognizes that this cruelty is a problem that is worthy of being redressed, and they form this organization. And the part that is really critical, is that not only is this just an organization that has legal stature behind it, because now there's legislation behind it, but it has enforcement. He's given a badge, and he's given the power to arrest. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
That seems incredibly, incredibly powerful. And I want you to talk about that a little bit, about what that does for him and his cause. But I'm a little confused that the ability to arrest is bestowed by, is that a city authority, a municipality, a county, a state? How is he given that right? And is he an adjunct of the police? Does he work in concert with them? How does that ability to arrest work?
That's what a lot of people wanted to know once they had granted him the power. It's like, why did we do this? You know, as he took this power and took it in all sorts of directions that nobody quite expected. You know, this is often considered to be the most important innovation. There were plenty of people who were against cruelty, you know, and there had been laws in general that against cruelty that had no enforcement mechanism. But Berg got, this was a state power, for branches of the SPCA, as they spread across the state, to hire and put into the field their own deputies. And these people could either make arrests themselves. They were, you know, largely sent in the field in order to admonish people, to advise them, you know, let them know that there was such a law and hope that they would straighten up. But certainly there were many incorrigible cruelists, as they called them, and these agents were capable of either arresting them or, in some cases, when necessary, they were empowered to call on the police to help bring them to justice. I think the idea here partly was that the police weren't likely to care about the problems of animals. They had bigger, more immediate human concerns. And also that cruelty itself is a kind of a hard thing to define. If you are, you know, nobody was challenging the right of people to whip their horse, for example. The question is, when does whipping become cruelty? Mm-hmm. When does it become unnecessary, right? You're allowed to take your cow and chop its head off and chop it into pieces and eat it, but you're not allowed to be cruel to it on the way to the slaughterhouse, mm-hmm. you know? And so for a lot of people, this was a brand new idea. You know, this is your property. You should be able to do whatever you want with it. And so the agents were really figuring out where that line was between acceptable use and abuse, really for the first time.
And it's a lot of ways we're still grappling with that. I think there's a question. Sure. That he set the stage. Now, so he has this power. And as you've mentioned, that really what the catalyst was, what he saw in Russia was the horses. And he spends much of his time with dealing with the issue of cruelty to the horses, both the trolley horses in New York. Horses, there's a lot of horses seem to be an agreeable, if you will, target. People who see the abuses might not push back on it. And yet, this is not his first thing he does when he after he gets. He goes after turtles. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. This did shock people. I mean, everybody who signed off and you know, as we've been saying, but lots of people were supportive of the idea of a law against cruelty. They had seen the cruelty to horses in their streets. But Berg, you know, the other thing besides appointing agents that Berg did was that he took quite literally the idea that all animals are protected by this law and not just the ones that everybody expected to be protected. So his first big sensational trial was to arrest a ship captain who was shipping a load of green turtles. They were a delicacy in New York City. And so they would be shipped up from Key West, deprived of food and water, flipped on their backs so that they wouldn't flop around too much, and back together by ropes that were done through their flippers. And so Berg arrests the ship captain and drags him to court and makes the argument that this is cruelty to animals. And the defense is said aren't animals, you know, or turtles don't feel anything, you know, that the low level of a nervous system, that how can you be cruel to something that's, you know, is practically. So there's this really strange argument over the nature of turtles. And some say, well, it's, you know, turtles are not animals, they're fish, or turtles are, you know, somewhere between a crab and an oyster. And you know, you get a sense of the very low level of biological understanding in the Gilded Age in these debates. And Berg loses, but he always, years later, said, well, he really won because people were so shocked that he was worried about the fate of turtles that they paid attention. And this is what he needed to get the movement started. You know, the whole country was interested in this strange wealthy man who is bothering to haul ship captains to court and in defense of turtles.
Yeah, and that fight over the turtles kind of sets the tone and the stage for him in terms of every time he does anything kind of other than horses, he has this, it's the same tone, right? Why are you bothering with this? And there's something like he became less ridiculed. The ridicule sort of becomes like a constant theme throughout. Yes. as he's doing. And yet he perseveres. I found that kind of remarkable.
Yes. Yeah. He was an easy target because he was very, you know, he didn't have a real sense of humor. And never evidence of him, you know, the few times in the record where he tries to crack a joke, it's really a very, very bad one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he takes himself very seriously. He always appears impeccably dressed in the streets of New York, even if he's hauling a Teamster off his wagon and throwing him in the gutter for, you know, daring to defy the law. He still is wearing his top hat and his silver cane, and you know.
And he's kind of a big guy too, right? He's
6 feet, and he used every inch of it to impose the law when he could. So he's an interesting target. People find him fascinating. He has a kind of a long, droopy mustaches, and you know, a sort of sad face, and everybody assumes that that's because he's constantly thinking about sad things that have happened to stray cats and things. He's a sort of a figure of fun for some, and then, you know, many people say this guy has a conscience that is, you know, leading us forward, you know, that he's seeing things that we all should see. And you know, Bergism becomes something that a lot of people decide to sign up for.
Bergism, it became
a term that got sometimes coined. You know, sometimes for people to, you know, to make fun of it. Now, here's another Bergism. You know, he's worried about a stray cat that gets you know, put into a cellar hole. You know, that's a Bergism, you know. But others felt like, you know, Bergism became essentially standing up for the welfare of animals.
Okay. All right. So, we're going to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we're going to get back to his roots, I guess, in a way, which is the discussion of horses, and particularly, long before we had COVID, we had America's first energy crisis, which was a plague that hit horses. And we're going to hear about that right when we come back. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn. That's Frankie and Chase, guys. When I adopted them, I discovered that they both have incredible personalities. Chance's sole purpose in life is to love and to be loved. Frankie is a little bit of a scoundrel and always entertaining. They're a little bit of a lot of things, but they're all pure love. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
All right, we're back here on The Other Animals here on WWDB. We're talking with Professor Ernest Friedberg from the University of Tennessee, who's written the book on Henry Berg, and he's the founder of ASPCA in New York and credited with creating the conscience of the animal rights movement in the United States shortly after the Civil War. Now, we had right before the break here about this concept of America's first energy crisis, and this took the form of a virus, a plague, I guess, that attacked the nation's horses. I was wondering if you could tell us about that. Why, first of all, what we're talking about the Gilded Age and what the unbelievable dependency on horses was that this made people sit up and take notice, and how did this virus impact that?
Right. Yeah, the virus broke out in the fall of 1872 in Toronto and spread incredibly rapidly. You know, we know about it, that you know, every city that it arrived in, and it essentially arrived in every city in the United States, 75 to 80% of the horses would be sick with this debilitating flu within a day or two, and in some cases as many as 90-95% of the horses got sick. About 5% died from this. The rest of them were unable to work for anywhere between 2 or 3 weeks, sometimes longer. And so everywhere that the flu arrived, it was an experiment in what happens if you take horses out of the American economy. The American economy collapses because it was a disaster everywhere it went, rippling across the country. It finally burned out in Nicaragua a year later, but really everywhere it went, it taught everybody a lesson about how dependent people were on.
So, example, like what the horses in the cities don't really think about it. We know of streetcars and subways, you know, mass transit, but in this period, the streetcars the trolleys were being hauled by horses. The barges along the canal hauled by horses. It wasn't your cowboy delivering, Pony Express. Everything moved by horse. This was our mobility, right?
That's right. I mean, we think of this time period as the golden age of the railroad, but of course the railroad could not possibly function without the coal that came out of the mines through horses and mules, and brought to market through horses and mules. And even just moving trains around the depot was often done by tugging them with horses. And then once the train arrived in the station and unloaded, it was absolutely essential that horses came along to carry these things away. Yeah. They were piled up in the depots during this plague that railroad companies started to say, we're just not going to Pittsburgh anymore. There are just too many things piled up on the depot. We can't drop anything off. We're done.
So this really, not just, I don't want to say it's a Bergism, but this really exposed, as people were trying to squeeze out the very last ounce of energy that the horses could provide, just unbelievably, right? You would have horses literally on their, with their dying breath, and people were trying to keep getting them to haul. Tell us a couple of the stories with that, just so people get an image of how.
Right. I mean, this is a terrible illness, but the one thing that might help a horse survive would be to give it rest and decent food and bedding, and hope that it would be able to pull through over the course of that time. There are many people who are totally dependent on their horses and just, refused to stop them from working. And some of them were people who themselves were right on the margins of poverty. And if unable to work, they themselves weren't able to work, mm-hmm. their horses to work in these situations. And this created an even worse sort of secondary illness, a sort of pulmonary reaction that caused the horses to swell horribly and die a very, very painful death almost, overnight. So this is really where agents manned the streets, set themselves up in intersections to try to stop this from happening, and inspected all the horses as they went by, and sent many of them back to the barns. And I think the most striking example of how dependent people were on horses was when fire broke out in November in Boston. And this was in a warehouse district full of buildings that people thought were fireproof, but they were also crammed full of all kinds of materials because the horse flu had prevented horses from delivering them. So leather and linens and paper and that so forth. And so this major section of downtown Boston started to burn, and the horses were too sick to carry the fire. And so as a result, a huge, acres and acres, many people lost their lives and millions of dollars of damage because the horses were sick.
I listened to the story, and I'm here because you mentioned it previously that he had the, he was constantly, Berg and his agents were constantly fighting this uphill battle of why are you devoting resource energy to animals when people are suffering. So you have this, he's trying to prevent a carriageman, who's virtually broke on himself on his last, got another nickel. And, there's indignation. Like, why do you care so much about the horse? What about the poor horseman who has a family back home? Right. All that.
Right.
I'm just wondering how this was a constant, how did Berg come to terms? What was his resolution with that, or did he have one?
Yeah, he did. I mean, they had to grapple. You're right; they had to grapple with this all the time. They were accused, as the title of the book suggests, of being traitors to their species. Putting the interests and rights of other creatures over the needs of human beings. And Berg responded in several ways, and so did his allies. One was to say that there were lots of organizations that helped human beings, and it was not unreasonable to have one organization that was looking out for the welfare of this other every other species. And the other part of it was, and this is an interesting argument that goes back to the time of slavery, one of the that anti-slavery piece was that as that's the institution of slavery is terrible for the slave, of course, but it's also the master, because it encourages inclusiveness of soul you know, an indifference to violence that bleeds into their entire worldview and their life. You know, that that how they treat their slave tells you something about how they're going to treat everybody else in their life. Mm-hmm. And for Berg and for many of his allies, the argument was this, it was similar in the sense that, you know, people who are cruel to their animals are cultivating a kind of lack of sensitivity to pain and suffering that that if, is also going to in the way they treat each other.
Yeah. And and again, that's one of those themes that's, that remains with us.
Sure.
You know, we go the term the link, where, you know, people have associated as a, you know, as a child, if you're, if you show cruel animals, you're going to, you know, grow up. There's some equivocation, you know, in terms of how accurate it is, but it's generally well accepted marker of things to come. And but yet it's interesting that you said Berg was not blind to that, because he, and I thought this was an interesting part in the book, he did help with this formation of the prevention of cruelty to children.
Yes.
Right. He, and in fact, he said he served on the board.
That's right.
I think that's an important, if you just talk about that for a second, because I think that that's important. He managed.
Yeah. This, I mean, this gets back to what we were saying about the importance of these agents, because people started to come to Berg pretty soon after the ASPCA was launched and say, look, I see that you're being effective in stopping cruelty to horses and stray dogs and kittens. You know, I know a child who's, you know, being abused every night. I can hear it through the walls. You know, help that person, you know, with these agents. Again, this police were not sure that it was their right, the right of the families to do what they want with their children, whether children are quasi property in that sense, you know, so the police were not willing to touch this. Berg said, look, that, you know, a child is an animal too, and they deserve protection as the horses I'm protecting. So he did, you know, that he was always saying, I need to concentrate on animals. He was very much involved in founding the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children.
Yeah.
And became a supporter of it for the rest of his life.
And I like that part of it, because it showed that he made that connection, you know, that he was not insensitive to that. I thought it was significant that he was supportive of it, but he did not off the what his role was. He stayed active with ASP Animals. He let, you know, he supported it. He supported the children's effort, but he didn't try to take a leadership role in that.
And that's right. And he always felt it had to be, they had to be two separate organizations.
It had to be, yeah.
You know, some people said, why not make it a society for prevention of all kinds of cruelty, you know, children and animals. But he and some of his allies, the leaders of the movement said, you know, that's really, in the end, that will mean that we'll focus exclusively on humans. You know, it's a good cause, essential cause, but we also need something, you know, to focus on animals, or we're going to lose that piece of this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So there's so much yet we did. We're not even going to try to talk about the delightful battles with P.T. Barnum, but we wanted to spend a few minutes on. He wasn't alone. He was part of, if I understand right, himself, George Angell from Boston, and here in the city of Brotherly Love, we had Caroline Earle White, who was represented both the, she was the woman of the trio, that perspective to it. But Philadelphia actually has a very, takes a leadership role. I was wondering if you spend a few minutes to tell us a little bit about her, Caroline Earle White, some of what happened in Philadelphia and how it distinguished itself.
Yeah, I mean, she is really an important, fascinating character in her own right, and really, you know, for really close to five decades, was a leader in this movement. When Berg launched this movement in 1866, there was something going on in the air, because it was, you know, while he realized it was time to do this, George Angell in Boston was pretty much almost, you know, within months pursuing the same thing, and Caroline Earle White in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. She went to Berg and, you know, got some advice about how to do this, and started to help found the Pennsylvania SPCA. She was told by male board of trustees, the leaders there, that there really was not a place for women in the organization as leaders. You know, they could be auxiliary and supporters. So she had the women's branch of the PSPCA, which really turned out to be the much more creative, energetic, and successful branch of the movement. in a lot of different directions, quite an innovative in developing, you know, some of the institutions that we think of today. I think most notably the dog shelter or the pet shelter, you know, that whole idea, which we just assume a way to handle animal control, was pioneered by Carol. And you know, up until that point, dog control in a quite brutal ways. And she really humanized, much more humane, that whole process.
So Philadelphia has the first dog shelter in the country?
In the world.
In the world. Awesome. Wow. Yeah. There you go. Now, I need to... One of the recurring themes of Berg as he's you know, with his efforts is that anytime he's really advocating on behalf of any animal other than a horse, I see this constant, oh, you're being effeminate, you're being feminine, yeah, you're having feminine sensitivities. So when Carol and Earl White comes along, she's like my hero. she is the voice. Like, what does she do? Does she own it?
Well, first of all, she's tough. And one of the things that, the real problem of animal control that they're grappling with, you know, of course, is you can put animals in shelters, but at a certain point, the shelters fill. And so you have to deal with, basically they were dealing with the problem of how to euthanize thousands of pets or stray animals. There were a tremendous number of stray dogs in American cities in this period. You know, and it was considered a serious social problem. And she and her allies pioneer the use of the gas chamber as a form of euthanasia that is more humane than the alternatives, which are, you know, horrendous. She had to be pretty tough to do that. You know, she's ridiculed soft and creating a hotel for dogs and so forth. She was very, very strong and built quite a coalition around this and fought back in quite effectively. You know, it's sort of her filler background.
Yeah. I said, did Berg ever, was both ways? I must have learned something from her. That it wasn't, you know, you'd mentioned, you know, that she got advice from him, but I would imagine as they were collaborating, he must have picked something up along the way from anything.
Yes, I think so. It was certainly that idea of how to run a pet shelter and the idea of developing humane forms of euthanizing animals. Both of those were pioneered in Philadelphia, but then adopted by Berg and by Angel in Boston and really spread across the country and the world. I mean, the ladies of Philadelphia who were sticking up for animals were quite proud of their gas chamber and, you know, spread the idea all around congresses and they never published a pamphlet in these years without a little diagram of how the gas chamber worked. Not something you'd expect from
I hear that. I'm just thinking about her legacy and Berg's legacy. You know, for her, actually the three of them, the trio there, George as well, they were always out there. You know, they're willing to accept this ridicule. There's a sense of and like I say, it seems to go to the modern day that they constantly being accused of going so far, of going too far. And that because they're going so far, they're actually doing damage to the cause that they're fighting for. I mean, you got to think PETA. I mean, that's what they're constantly being accused of. But it started back then, you know. It started back then that you're what are you doing? You're actually harming the cause that you're to help. All three of them, you know, they confronted this. And I don't know, in the few minutes that we have left here, I just wonder, is that their legacy? Or if you had to sum up their legacy, or Berg in particular, well, what do you think it would be?
Yeah, well, I think all three of them, you know, by refusing to back down on this, you know, by pushing the idea that this wasn't simply a reform to stop people from, you know, beating their trolley horses, but that this was, you know, they opened up this conversation to think about all of creation, you know, and our obligations to all species. That this, you're right, they were ridiculed for this. They were always, you know, a sign of their success was that fairly quickly, even their critics said it was a good cause. The problem is they're ruining it, you know. But so everybody had to at least concede that, yes, cruelty is a problem, needs to be dealt with. There are examples where this is necessary, But you know, don't push it too far. And, you know, as Berg and others would say, you know, that you're against everybody except the one that, you know, that you prefer.
Yep.
Except
the one that impacts you and your bottom line.
Right. And exactly.
Not in my backyard, a different flavor of that. All right. Hey, listeners, we're out of time. I definitely want to thank, again, the book is called To His Species, Henry Berg, the Animal Rights Movement. Where can people go for more information to get the book? Or is there any website you'd like to have them take a look at?
Well, I mean, it's published by Basic Books. That would be okay. A place to send. Obviously, the independent bookseller is the first choice.
We do like them. Yes, we do. All right. Again, that's Ernest Freeberg, University of Tennessee. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
All right. Yeah, I'll tell you what, that is a great interview. There's a lot more that we talked about afterwards. And I can't recommend the book strongly enough. It's just a delight. You just go through it. You know, it's nonfiction, but it's a page turner. So definitely go check it out. All right. Hey, listen, when we return, we're going to take this scenario. Your vet has given Fluffy her first dosage, and she made it look so easy. But now it's your turn. So Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls is here to help. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard. Come take care of your pets from the comfort of their home. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. Would rather catch mice.
Yeah, we're back on The Other Animals on WWDB. Join now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. All right, Tom, I hope I set that up for you really well, because that is a common scenario. I have watched my vet with my cats and even our dogs when we had them, and they pop them, give them the injections. Boy, that looks easy. And then you come home, and it isn't easy at all. What do you tell clients?
Oh, yes. It can be very, very difficult. You know, most vets and people who work places have given these medicine 10 times, so we can make it look easy, but it isn't easy. And one of the first to do is, I'm sorry, I'm getting my voice echoed back at me, so I'm having trouble thinking. Let me just turn my volume.
We've had a lot of technical issues on the show today. I got a lot of static too, so I guess we're just going to try and muddle through as best we can.
Yes, I'll try and go ahead. Listen to myself here. The first thing you should do is get very specific directions from the doctor. This includes human doctors for your human medicine, too. I see lots of errors and confusions made that are pretty critical, like treating, for example, an eye infection or an ear infection with an oral medication that you give your pet by mouth. You know that because I've had many people try to put that medication directly in the eye or in the ears. So that's a common error.
That's awful. Oh my! Wait. They tried to dispense an oral medicine with an eye drop into the eye or into the ear. Is that? Oh my God.
Yes.
You have I don't think to I've make ever done sure. I feel better already.
It seems obvious, but it's not always obvious.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. The other is making sure you understand the dosage. Those little lines on the droppers or the amounts that you give them can be critical because, you know, many medications have a wide range of safety. But many of them, you know, it doesn't take much to set them off. If you give a little bit too much, even the normal amount of, say, an oral antibiotic can cause diarrhea or vomiting. You don't want to give more. And you definitely don't want to give less because it's not going to work. So that's a thing. But then it comes to the actual giving of it. And if it's an eardrop that's meant to be put in the ear, or it's put in the ears. The little tricks that we do for that is similar to putting eye drops directly in the ear. Sure, it's supposed to go in the eyes or ears to begin with. One of the tricks for those is to make sure you're resting the side of your hand on your pet, particularly eye drops. So if they jump, they knock your hand away. If you kind of hover over the eye trying to like put an eye drop in and they jump, they're going to jump their eye right off. So those are little things like that.
What do you do? What do you do in those cases? Either, I would say, well, you could look at either an oral dispense, a liquid oral dispense, or the, what you're talking about, eardrops or eye drops, when you dispense and the cat or dog shakes, right? Does wags the head and some of it spills out. Then it seems like you have this guessing game, like, oh crap, do I reapply it? How much do I reapply? How much do I guess did the dog shake out? How much got in? How much didn't? Do you ever run the what would you tell someone who's worrying about overdosing or underdosing? Is there a couple of them?
Generally speaking, I say if you're not sure, don't dose again. For ears, I recommend gently scrunching the ears around so it kind of spreads it. So anything they shake out is probably negligible. Eye drops, if you miss a little bit or it starts to run out down their face, that's fine. Probably got some in there. And just wait till the next dose. It is similar to that about medications and not overdosing is, for example, insulin, which unfortunately you've had a lot of experience with lately.
I was just going to ask you about that. Part of the drama with that is
after they've eaten a full meal. So if you're not sure if they ate a full meal, it's much safer to skip. Wait till the next. Medicines can be quite dangerous if they're given improperly in the wrong location or the wrong amount.
I was going to ask, because insulin is administered via, sometimes there's a little bit of guesswork there. Like if you're not really skilled at it, sometimes you're not sure whether you got it. You know, you think, like for a cat, I know you sort of do it by the scruff of the neck, you know. And, sometimes, did the needle get in? Did some of it drip out? And again, it sounds like what you're saying is that if you're not sure, don't try again, right?
For the vast majority of medications, if you're not sure, just skip that dose. If you think you gave it, but you're not sure, just wait till the next dose. It's way more common to have
tips on
overdose problems than underdose.
Do you have any tips on injections? For people that have never done it before, there are
a whole other categories. My tips for like say giving oral medication, which is much more, one, get them to take it dissolved in their food or mixed into food. That's probably ideal. Keep in mind, ask the doctor too. Some medications are not properly if they're taken with too much food or a certain type of food. So you have to be aware of that. And giving in foods relatively easier. But there's a lot of pets who will just look at you like, no, I'm not eating that. I know something's
nice
in there.
Nice try.
Directly in the mouth is better.
Pill poppers and all that.
Yeah, little pill guns. It takes some skill to do that.
Yeah.
Some nerve because, it's hard to treat your own pet. They're just struggling with you and they don't want it. And you kind of feel a little nervous and some of your own pet will bite too.
Yep. All right. Hey, listen, Tom, we're out of time. That's really helpful. I hope people got some out of it because that's good stuff to know. So listen, we're out of time. I want to thank my guest, Ernest Freeberg. Apologize for our technical difficulties, but thank my producer, Matt Minarek, sitting in for Jason today. Always want to hear from you with your comments, ideas, or suggestions. If you've got topics you'd like Dr. Picard to discuss, check out theotheranimals.com and let us know. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at theotheranimals, same space there over on Facebook. And don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, when it comes to our pets, is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? As the poem goes, well, a recent study says maybe not. And we're going to talk with the lead author on that study.
Please join us Mondays and Saturdays at 2.
Until then, find the belly to rub. Stay safe, everyone.